Okay, yeah, so yeah, thanks for letting me speak. Yeah, I'll tell you about ongoing work with Will DiRocco, who's a grad student at Stanford, and then Peter Surjit, and also Den, who is an astrophysicist at Berkeley, who's helping us with the be more serious, sort of actually keeping us straight. Yeah, and it's very much work in progress, so please make comments, ask questions. It's great to get feedback. And yeah, I don't want to spend any time motivating why dark matter is super exciting and we should be searching for it. And just want to sort of remind you, even though I guess we are the sensitivity frontier, that dark matter searches is a very mature field. It's been going on for a long time. There has been great progress. And especially in sort of this WIMP paradigm, where WIMP is very generic, but as soon as for masses above 10 GeV, we have a very, very sort of solid path forward. It's sort of we've been pushing down in sensitivity, building bigger, better detectors, and we've currently reached sort of about here. Those xenon 1-ton should have results any day now. I think they're delayed by almost a month already from the original expectation. And we're going to gain sensitivity, and I think nothing is going to stop this experimental program until it reaches sort of the neutrino floor, which is when the detectors are so big that they're going to start seeing lots of events from atmospheric neutrinos. And I guess a lot of our program is figuring out what's going on to the left of this plot, right? I mean, we now maybe the motivation for multi-GeV particles is not as big as it used to be because we thought there would be more physics at the weak scale, and so we should be more agnostic and search for dark matter in sort of in most of its viable parameter space. And the complications as you go to lower energies, to lower masses, is that there's just less energy available in dark matter for you to detect, and this is just the biggest problem. For example, if you're looking for something that gives you an energy recoil, you're looking for to observe the dark matter kinetic energy. We know that the dark matter in our galaxy has velocities of about 10 to the minus 3 of the speed of light, and so the kinetic energy is 10 to the minus 6 down from its mass, and therefore as soon as you go to sub GeV, you're looking at detecting sub KeV energy deposits, which is challenging experimentally. And the other problem you have to face is that backgrounds just rise as you go to lower energies. And so, for example, here is how many events you would expect to see if you were able to just lower your energy threshold. And you see that when you go below about 5 keV, you start seeing a lot more background. This is partly this. Oh no, I'm going the wrong way. It's this shoulder here, right? And as you go to lower energies, you start seeing solar neutrinos. And there are many kinds, and as you go to lower and lower energies, you see even more bigger fluxes of solar neutrinos, and you just get swamped by backgrounds. Those are two problems. We as a community have come with many ideas. Many of the people that came with these ideas are here or were here earlier. And one such idea is to search for electron scatterings. There you're still limited by the fact that you're still just you still have smaller kinetic energy available in dark matter, but it's just easier to see smaller energy depositions if you're searching for electrons. You can search for producing dark matter in accelerators, especially beam dump type experiments, and this is driving a lot of the exploring a lot of the parameter space. And people have been sort of spending lots of time thinking about new targets, new materials, or new strategies that would allow us to push lower and lower energies. And this has all focused on really detecting this dark matter population that is gravitationally bound to our galaxy, which is the biggest dark matter population that we have access to. But what we are proposing is to search for a different component of dark matter, not a different particle of dark, not saying that there's multi-component dark matter and we're searching for a small piece of it. Saying if dark matter is light, you can also produce it in some astrophysical environments. And those dark matter that are produced in astrophysical environments can come with much, much higher energies than the ones that would be gravitationally bound to our galaxy. And therefore, they're easier to detect. And sort of a useful analogy is if you are trying to search for the cosmic relic of neutrinos, that's a really, really hard job. But nowadays, detecting astrophysical neutrinos is sort of an everyday life thing for a neutrino astrophysicist. So it's sort of a very loose analogy that maybe we should go after the smaller component, but which is much more energetic per particle, and therefore easier to detect. And this is what my talk is about, is searching for dark matter that was produced inside supernovae. So supernova can get to tens of MeV energies, and therefore, if dark matter is produced inside there, it would come out with kinetic energies of the order of few MeV. So for masses that are below about 100 or 200 MeV, they can be efficiently produced inside the supernova, and they'll come out boosted, and therefore they can even trigger the big xenon detectors that we're building, those ones that I said we're going to push down all the way to the neutrino floor. So this is the aim of the talk, and the main problem is figuring out what is the flux of these things. I mean, it's complicated, and this is what most of the talk is about. So here is just a brief outline. I'm going to tell you about the very simple model that we'll explore. It's just we're here looking for simplicity because everything else is complicated, so the model better be simple, but it should be extendable to many other models as soon as we have everything under control. Then I'll tell you about what are the important features inside supernovae, and with that I'll tell you how we can compute fluxes and then what is the expected sensitivity of future experiments. Here is the model. It's really simple. We're going to think about a dark photon coupled to a fermionic dark matter, and the dark photon kinetically mixes with our photon. So this is the model we have in mind. In fact, this model is so simple that it's mostly excluded by CMB, but you can do small tweaks that don't change anything that I'm going to tell you about, and that makes it viable with CMB. You can make it small mass splitting, makes this pseudo drag, or make it asymmetric, so I'm not going to focus on that. I just want to stick to the simple model. And to make my life even simpler, I'm going to stick to a specific regime in this model. I'm going to stick to the regime where the dark photon is heavy compared to the energies of interest, so that it can integrate out the dark photon. And the energies of interest are that it has to be significantly above the dark matter mass, and it also has to be above some typical energies that can still be efficiently produced inside the supernova. So I'm going to assume that it's heavier than about 200 MeV. And in this case, all of the interactions with the standard model are parametrized by just a dimension 6 operator, current-current operator between the dark matter and the electromagnetic current of the standard model. So this is characterizes all of the interactions between the dark matter and us for the remainder of the talk. And because there are too many parameters in front of this dimension 6 operator, it's easier to take a specific combination of these parameters, which is this variable y. And then I'm going to parameterize everything in terms of y. And this is what a lot of people in fixed target experiments also use for these types of models. And the idea is just that a typical cross-section, if energies are comparable to the dark matter mass, typical cross-sections are just alpha nm times this dimensionless number divided by m squared, or the typical energy squared. And as I said earlier, a lot of this sub-GeV, and I guess above MeV mass range, is really being probed by accelerators. In large part, accelerators are the ones doing a lot of sort of scanning of the parameters. And a lot of the experiments are really just searching for an invisibly decaying dark photon. This is what a lot of them are really searching for. And here are the bounds on that. So this is the epsilon diskinetic mixing parameter and the mass of the dark photon. And once you make some assumption about the relationship between the mass of the dark matter and the dark photon and the dark coupling, you can recast this in terms of a dark matter bound, which is what is done here for a specific choice of sort of the dark matter is three times, the dark photon is three times heavier than the dark matter. And we are going to be exploring parameter space that's sort of around this region here. So it has a large overlap with Bell. A lot of the reason why we're forced to be here is that we want to be the dark photon to be heavy, and therefore we cannot have epsilon be too small. If we ever, once we clear everything out and figure out how to include also the dark photon inside of our estimates, make it lighter so we can include all the physics, then we in principle could go down here. And if I translate this into this region here, we are usually around here. I guess down to 200 MeV, sort of. We're going to be exploring regions around here.
The reason why you take a dark photon heavy is just for simplicity.
For simplicity, yeah. Total simplicity, yeah. You'll see why it did. No, more than that. Let me go back to this once I tell you how we're doing the estimate. And just to give you sort of a concrete feeling of what's going on, If I take some model, so some point in parameter space around here, and I really write down the dimension 6 operator, the dimension 6 operator is suppressed by a scale of about 50 GeV. So this is just to say that this, although this seems like very small couplings, in this regime, the dark matter is interacting with us more strongly than neutrinos. Right? So at low energies, its coupling to us more strongly than neutrinos. And as you go down, then it becomes more comparable to neutrinos.
So what about a bound from Z decay?
I mean, this is a very small coupling. I mean, the couplings are really, really small. I mean, it's just, see here, in epsilon squared, there's almost no bound on Z decays. I mean, epsilon squared is order 10 to the minus 8 already.
And it's suppressed by Na prime over MZ to the coupling to the Z.
Well, no, but you could, not the Z direct decay, but I think just also you could decay to E plus and minus and radiate an extra dark photon or something like that.
Just looking at that operator there, that doesn't quite replace J, E, and M with the Z curve.
Oh no, but you're saying if I couple this to the, so you mean direct coupling of dark matter to the Z in this case?
Oh, just that thing right there.
No, sorry, but you're saying like take this as the coupling and then put a Z mu here and then just decay the Z directly to dark matter?
Yeah.
No, but I mean this is already when I integrated everything out, right? I mean if I write down, if I put back the dark photon in and put the kinetic mixing, then the Z wouldn't couple directly to the dark matter, I think, except for loops that are highly suppressed. This 50 is not the mass, right? It also has the kinetic mixing in it. So the dark photons that we'll be thinking about are about sort of few hundred MeV to a few GeV. Yeah, I know, but this operator is really valid only at energies below a few hundred MeV. If you go above, then you have to start putting back everything in, and then things look significantly different. Yeah. I mean, the UV completion of this operator comes much before 50 GeV because of the kinetic mixing. Now let me tell you about what are the interesting features of supernova that will play a role. Supernova is just sort of, I don't know, I guess there are different kinds of supernova. We'll be focusing on core collapse supernova, which are type 2. And those are just the fate of very, very massive stars. So if you have stars that are very, very heavy, what happens is that they go through many different fusion cycles. They first fuse hydrogen, and then they move on into heavier and heavier elements until they start fusing into iron. Once you start fusing iron, iron has the largest binding energy per nuclei, so you cannot fuse any further. I mean, it's not energetically favorable, so you're not really using it as fuel anymore. And you can't use that to give you energy to prevent gravitational collapse. At that point, you just start accumulating iron, and iron goes to the center, and you start forming this iron core, which, because it doesn't actually generate energy through any type of nuclear process, what's preventing it from further collapsing is just electron degeneracy. So you just start piling up iron, and it's mostly being supported from collapse just by it's so compact that the electrons are degenerate, and they're providing a pressure component, which is preventing gravitational collapse. However, once this iron core grows to more than 1.5 solar mass, the even electron degeneracy is no longer enough to prevent gravitational collapse, and the whole thing crunches. And it goes from having few thousands of kilometers to just tens of kilometers. And so it just has this huge gravitational binding energy of something that has 1.5 solar masses into 6,000 kilometers and going to a few tens of kilometers, but remaining with the same mass. So it's a huge gravitational binding energy. And that goes mostly first lepton chemical potential, but then into heat. So that's why you really heat this up to very high temperatures. This collapse makes things so dense that even at some point the neutrinos are trapped. So this thing starts crunching, right? This thousands of kilometers thing, and in the beginning there's sort of lots of weak processes happening. So you're doing electron capture and releasing neutrinos, but at some point the density is so high that even those neutrinos that you're producing cannot escape and they get dragged to the center. So it's just a really impressive system. here's just a sort of cartoon picture of what goes on. As I said, there is an iron core which starts out at a few thousand kilometers and it gets crunched to a few tens of kilometers during this collapse. There's some radius from which not even the neutrinos can escape, as I said, and this grows over time because the density in the center is growing. And there's some other more complicated physics. This thing collapses until it eventually reaches some new type of pressure component that prevents further collapse. And that happens when the densities become comparable to nuclear densities. And then the equation of state stiffens by a lot, and you can't continually compress, and then it just bounces out. And so you have these things falling sort of at like supersonic speeds, and then it gets to very high densities, and it sort of cannot compress any further, and you create like a bounce, and some of it gets spelled out. And this physics is complicated. There's now people understand that this shock stalls, and therefore it cannot lead to explosion unless there's more complicated physics. And this is sort of a controversial part of the supernova community. People argue about what really happens there. But what we'll focus on is what happens after about 1 second, in which there's a lot of complicated things that were happening at further out radii, but in the center you just form this object, this which is called a proton-neutron star, which has order 10 to 20 kilometers. It's very, very, very hot. It has nuclear densities, and it's the thing that in many cases will lead to the formation of a neutron star in the end. And because this thing is very hot, it goes through a cooling phase, which is very efficient, especially in the first 10 seconds. So this phase is much less controversial. This people really think that we have under control, that we have reasonably good understanding of what's going on, and this is the phase that I'm going to focus on. One important thing to keep in mind is that this is not such a crazy idea. We've detected particles that are very weakly interacting that were made inside supernovas before. Well, we detected photons, but those are strongly interacting. But we detected neutrinos in the supernova in 1987A. And the place where these neutrinos that we detected were produced were exactly during this cooling phase, right? Here is sort of the neutrino luminosity, also in time after the core bounce. And there's like a high peak of electron neutrinos. Those are the ones that were produced because you were doing all this electron capture. You're deleptonizing your proton-neutron star, right? Because initially you had sort of comparable numbers of protons and neutrons, but in the end you have much more neutrons than protons. But this is only lasts for a very short burst. But at later times, you see that all flavors of neutrinos are produced at more or less equal luminosities. And those were the neutrinos that we detected. We detected order 20 neutrinos from that supernova. And so the idea is that, well, if we could detect neutrinos, maybe we can also detect other things that are weakly coupled and can be produced inside this object. So let me tell you what are the sort of important features and / complications of this when you try to do dark matter inside of neutrinos. There are two things that are important. One is that in all the cases that we will be interested in, that you could actually detect this on Earth, the interactions are so large that it's not that you can just compute how many things were produced and you just declare that all of them make it out. Most of them interact so strongly that they stay trapped inside the supernova for a while. And because of that, because they stay trapped, they have a chance of just finding another dark matter and annihilating back into the standard model. So it's not just a counting game of I can just compute how many things are produced. It's more complicated than that. It also, and this is also true for neutrinos, so people, because we try to understand the neutrino flux, this is sort of reasonably well understood, although because there are differences between neutrino and the dark matter, we have to be a little bit careful here. The other thing, if you've thought about a lot of times when you think about supernova physics, you're thinking about very light things being produced inside, and then they come out being ultra-relativistic. This is not the case if you're looking at particles that have masses of above an MeV. In that case, things have masses comparable to the temperature, so they come out semi-relativistically, but they're definitely not ultra-relativistic. And so there is a lot more velocity spread than the neutrinos had. And this is also an important feature. So let me start first explaining the effect of the velocity spread, because I guess our first estimate we had ignored this, and it turns out to be a hugely important effect. So if you think about just a dark matter with about a mass of 10 MeV, and you assume that because it's it has such large interactions, it has reached some sort of thermal equilibrium, so the spectrum that you're seeing out looks like a black body spectrum. You can also describe the momentum distribution of the things that you're seeing further out just as a Fermi-Dirac distribution. And you see that there's a very broad distribution in momentum, right? So now, if I just look here, what is the typical energy? The typical energy is something around 60-70 MeV, which is higher than the mass, but it's not a factor of sort of significantly, it's not incredibly larger than the mass. So if I compute what is the velocity from something that has typical energy, I get that it has 98% of the speed of light, which is fairly relativistic, but it's not one. Well, the supernova 1987A was at 50, it was in the Large Magellanic Cloud, which is about 55 kiloparsecs away. That's almost 200,000 light years. So this 2% difference in the speed of from the speed of light means that they're going to take 2% times this distance more than the neutrinos to reach us, which means that we still have thousands of years to see this, and we might even be able to propose a KITP workshop to discuss how to detect this. I think if we hurry, we have time. And the other thing is that things that are, because the distribution is so broad, if you are sort of tracking a dark matter that had momentum in the high end versus something that had in the low end, they'll arrive here at very, very different times. So even though this cooling phase only lasts about 10 seconds, because the time of flight is very different depending on where you were in this momentum distribution, the signal is going to get hugely spread in time, right? So let's say if there's a sort of percent type difference in the velocity between this part of the spectrum versus this part of the spectrum, this 1% also gets multiplied by this huge distance, and so the signal, instead of lasting 10 seconds, is going to last also thousands of years. But the total number is fixed, right? I mean, if you put like a near detector, and we think about ourselves as the far detector, the number is the flux conserved, but not the flux, which means that the instantaneous flux goes down by a lot on Earth because of this huge spreading of the signal. So those are two features of this, which mostly seem bad in terms of detection, but in the mindset that you should always see things as a feature and not as a problem. One thing that 1987A, I guess maybe the only features that we have a lot of time to think what to do about this. But the signal spread, there is a positive aspect to it. It's not good that the overall instantaneous luminosity, that instantaneous flux goes down by so much. But on the other hand, because things take so long to get to us, we actually get to see much older supernovae, which, and potentially they were closer by supernovae. So that's a good aspect of this. And the other thing is, because now the signal lasts for thousands of years, there is about 2 supernovas per century in our galaxy, you can actually see many signals from many, many supernovas are getting to us at the same time. So you have this diffuse background of signals. So instead of being just a burst, you have just this continuous thing coming from many different directions, which is a more, in a sense, a more robust and more certain prediction than hoping that we can find a specific old supernova that will fit the bill. The other thing that I said is that we need to take into account the large interactions, right? So, as I said, the interactions, even though it's weak coupling, the interactions are so large and the densities are so high that dark matter will have many, many interactions. After you create a dark matter particle, it will probably have many, many interactions before it actually makes it out. And once some of these interactions can just be annihilating back into the standard model, and therefore you lose that particle. And the other thing that also happens is that also the energy can change, because you produce something in a hotter region, but maybe it scatters a bunch of times until it reaches some cooler region, and then it exchanges a lot of energy there, and it will come out colder than where it was produced. So maybe we don't actually get to use this sort of tens of MeV of the core, and you end up only being sensitive to somewhat slightly smaller temperatures. Luckily, at least this part was fairly well understood for the neutrinos, and I'm going to try to draw as much analogy to that, because that's well understood, as possible. So for the neutrinos, people can first run simulations and things like this, but there's also a relatively good analytical understanding of what's going on with the neutrinos. And the idea is that because all interactions are super fast, sort of, you can think that roughly what's happening is always a steady state for the neutrinos, for the neutrino production. But there is a steady state with a changing in space, right? So you're trying to see what is the flux of something through media that has spatial dependence in the properties of the media. So now here, instead of trying to figure out what is the sort of a freeze out in time type process, you actually have some sort of decoupling as you move in space. As you go to colder and colder places, some interactions are going to shut off just because the temperatures now are too small, and usually things go at some high power of the typical energy, and therefore different reactions can shut off. And for the neutrinos, there are a lot of interactions that are important in the core. They're sort of just neutrinos interacting with nuclei, neutrinos being pair-produced from nucleon-nucleon Bram-Strahlunging. Also, interactions with electrons, which can also pair-produce neutrinos, or neutrinos exchanging energy with electrons. Turns out that for neutrinos, all of those shut off at roughly the same radius, in particular for muon and tau neutrinos. For electron neutrinos, it's different because of charge interactions. And so at some radius, almost all of these reactions, except for the interaction with the nucleus, shut off. And this fixes both the flux, the total number of neutrinos that are making it out of that region, and also it tells you roughly about the energy spectrum of those neutrinos. And then those neutrinos still need to diffuse out until this reaction is no longer efficient. But because the mass of the nucleus is much higher than typical energy of the neutrinos, this reaction doesn't really change the properties of the neutrinos very much. So it's really just a slowing of the process that happens. But there's no significant change in either the number or the energy of the neutrinos that comes from this. So we're going to do exactly the same, but we're also working on doing a more numerical approach to this, which would be complementary to what I'm going to tell you now, but this is not ready yet. This is what Dan is really helping us do. He's writing up a Monte Carlo to sort of really evolve the production of neutrinos inside the supernova, assuming a static supernova background. So we're not considering any feedback into the supernova, but to try to see if our analytical estimates are accurate or not. So hopefully within a few weeks we'll have results for this. But today I'll just tell you about the analytical understanding. And the idea is to do this sort of freeze-out calculation that I was talking about, but instead of doing freeze-out in time, which maybe you're more familiar with, which is just comparing, let's say if I want to see if a reaction is in equilibrium or not, I compare it to the useful time scale in the process. So for example, if you're doing early universe cosmology, you compare some reaction rate to the expansion rate of the universe, and if it's faster than the expansion rate, you declare that locally that reaction is in equilibrium. So for us, it will be a freeze-out in time, but the logic is very similar. Here, instead of rates, you're interested in mean free paths. You want to see how far something can travel before it has a relevant reaction. And what you're typically comparing it to is either the size of your object or the distance that you need to go until some property of that object changes significantly, which would be comparable to Hubble, right? So if densities are dropping very fast, or if temperatures are dropping very fast, is a typical distance that you need to travel for temperatures or densities to drop significantly. And with that picture, you'll have then there's really three things that are going to happen, and you can think about it as a freeze-out in different shells. So there are three different processes that we care about. There is a number changing process, so process that allow the number density of dark matter to change. Here I'm focusing mostly on dark matter creation and annihilation through the interaction with electrons. There's also Bram-Strahlung through nucleon-nucleon, which we haven't included because for most of our parameter space that's not the dominant, this is not the relevant one. But as you go to smaller couplings, typically that becomes important too. And in all that I'll tell you from now on, I'm ignoring that. But in the end result that we're doing in the simulation, we're going to include both.
That always in that order.
It's more or less. There are a few cases where the electron sphere is very sort of the energy sphere is inside the number sphere. But because the number changing process is also exchange energy. So basically, this reaction can keep you both in chemical and thermal equilibrium. So if this reaction is ever less efficient than this, then these two just collapse to the same sphere, which is what happens to the neutrinos, for example. The neutrinos, both reactions shut off roughly at the same radius. Yeah?
So I'm confused with what you're saying. So dominant production of the dark matter is through nuclear neutron function, right?
Only inside the core, in the very center, in the first 10 or 15 kilometers.
So So the number sphere that you take in, that's
going to be it's going to be usually outside for usually in all the case, yeah. I mean,
well,
this is
just because the Hamiltonian number is not that high. I mean, the nuclei dominate.
The nuclei dominate, but so yeah, maybe yeah. This is jumping ahead of things. So if you look at sort of the first, I mean, we are looking at a profile that has about 15 kilometers at the time that we're of our snapshot. And sort of in the first 9 kilometers, is true that there are very few positrons. That's the main problem, because the chemical potentials are so large. But because the chemical potential starts to decrease towards the edge, and the temperature sharps up also towards the edge, at the edge, the number of positrons and electrons is not that different than the number of nuclei. But still, at that region, the Bram-Stralongin and E plus E minus are comparable. But as soon as your density starts to drop, and they drop really fast, Bram-Stralongin becomes inefficient, and E plus E minus becomes efficient, because then it's just a thermal population of E plus E minus. And for most of our coupling, if our number changing sphere ever moves inside, typically we are already in a cooling regime, which we're declaring is not what we're looking for. But it, maybe it will become clear when I show everything. So for cooling, it's definitely mostly Bram-Stralongin, but for when you're trapped until further out, then it's E plus E minus. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, maybe this will become more clear when I show some other things. Yeah, so there's some number changing process that will freeze out, then usually after that, the energy, the process that allows, and so that will fix the total flux. Then there is some, then there is the process that allows to exchange energy, and again, it exchanges energy efficiently with electrons because electrons are light. While it doesn't exchange energy so efficiently with protons, because protons are too heavy, so it just bounces back as off some sort of infinitely heavy wall. And so when this process becomes inefficient, it essentially stops exchanging energy with the medium. And this last process just declares when it stops diffusing. I mean, at that point, once this process shuts off, it can just free streams. So those are the three things. And from this, you might be wondering, like, oh, come on, like, if this one only is the thing that's setting it to free stream versus, but it doesn't really change any of its properties, maybe you can just completely ignore it, which I hope would be true, because it gives us a larger signal, but it's not true. And the main reason is the following, right? So when I told you about how you do freeze-out calculations in space, that naive picture that you just see, oh, what is the mean free path for this reaction, and compare that to how far I need to travel until I get to a region where temperatures and densities have fallen significantly. That's only true if there's only one reaction happening, right? So in that case, really, I can just see, oh, okay, there's some mean free path for annihilation, and there's some distance that I need to travel until I can escape this very dense region. But if there is a much, much faster reaction that's setting a much shorter mean free path, it means that for me to actually travel this distance, I'm doing it in Brownian motion given by the diffusion length of the other reaction, which is stronger, which means that it takes a much, much longer time for me to go from one place to the other. Or in other words, even though it seems like I traveled only this distance, I effectively travel a much, much bigger distance. And therefore, if I'm diffusing through a different reaction, it makes all the other reactions much more efficient. So it just catalyzes all the other reactions. So this is the main effect of having the protons around. And in sort of more precise requirements, what we really do to declare, to find out when things freeze out, is that we compute the opacity of that reaction, which is just some radial integral. Imagine that you're radially streaming out of the particle divided by the mean free path of the reaction we're trying to do. So this is what you do if there's a single reaction. And once the opacity becomes smaller than one, your process has decoupled. Now, if you're diffusing through a different process and you want to see a process that has a much longer mean free path, and you want to find out when does this opacity become small, then you don't use just the normal mean free path, but you have to use an effective mean free path that takes into account both the reaction that you're interested in and the reaction that's setting your diffusion timescale. And there's just this geometric mean between the two. So we're, for almost all reactions, we're always in this regime because of the interaction with protons. And that, as I said, it just catalyzes all the other reactions. Okay, so now we have a procedure. We can now go ahead and find what is the radius at which the number density, number changing process frees out. And at that radius, you can imagine that your supernova, your proton-neutron star, is just emitting as a black body from that radius, right? Because, you know, if you move inside that radius, things annihilate very fast, and so they never make it out. So there are only things near the shell that are being emitted. So that's very much like a black body. And you can compute the number of flux that's coming outside this by just doing this integral over the Fermi-Dirac distribution. So it's similar to a black body radiation, except that you have Fermi-Dirac instead of Bose-Einstein. But the main difference is that because the thing has a mass, if the mass is above the temperature, you're going to get an extra Boltzmann suppression, which is not there for if you're just looking at photons. So it's more like e to the minus m over t times the correct power of t, so t cubed if it's number, and t to the fourth if it's energy flux. And with that, you kind of get the flux coming out, except that the protons still hurt you a little bit more. So you see that if I could find an astrophysical object that was very hot but didn't have protons, that would be the best. And the reason is that you're emitting from the surface, right? But almost by definition, the diffusion with the protons has not stopped yet. So you're emitting as a black body, and you're observing in the far infinity. But whatever you produce here in this sort of black body surface, it still needs to make out through a sea of lots of protons. And it's a diffusion process. So it's going to diffuse out, and because of the way diffusion works, we know that it doesn't, even though there's a net bias going this way because the reaction is less, sort of your diffusion, your densities are decreasing, therefore diffusion creates a net bias this way. A lot of times things are going to bounce a couple times and come back here. And because this is a black body, once things come back, they get reabsorbed. So you still lose some of the guys that you're emitting as a black body. And look, this is also an effect that happens for neutrinos, which is lucky because then at least there is a formula we can use. And it's just, it's sort of, how do you say, it's a transmission coefficient type calculation. Just see how many things are really transmitted through this complicated sea of protons. And it's just given by an opacity through the photons, but it's weighted by the fact that the geometry is spherical. So this was derived by Raphael, and he did some very nice modeling of how the neutrinos are produced inside the supernova. So this is so here's the flux that you would get just from the black body. This is the 1 over r squared that you typically get from diluting a flux, right, as you move to further radius. And then there's an extra transmission factor that hurts you a little bit more. So this sets the total flux. This, in a sense, is the most important part of the process. As I told you, there's another process that is in principle important, which is interacting with the electrons. That changes the energy. So what the way we're dealing with that is that we find some radius at which the number changing processes stop. That temperature, with that temperature, we can find what is the flux of dark matter coming out. But now those dark matter that are coming out can still exchange energy with the medium until they reach a different radius at which the interaction with electrons stop. So at that point, there's a temperature that's characteristic of the dark matter that's coming out. And so we just take this, the normalization of our flux is given by this, but the shape in terms of the momentum distribution is given by the temperature where it decouples from electrons. So this is where the electrons are coming in. So those are all, and after that, you don't actually care very much what happens. I mean, it bounces off the protons for a little bit. That probably delays the signal a little bit more. But given that the delay is going to be dominated by the signal spread in time of flight, this is a small effect. It doesn't really matter very much. So now I've told you all of the important physics of the flux. So the only thing that's left to do is that we need to actually get information about the supernova, right? I mean, in order to compute any of those things, I need to know the number density of protons, the number density of electrons, the temperature, things like this. And that then gave us the results of some 2D simulations for a supernova. And at about 1 second after the bounce, 1.5 seconds after the bounce, that's roughly where luminosities are starting to peak. So we're using this, but we're actually going to also explore different profiles. So far, we've been using this one profile. And you see that sort of this is the density of the supernova as a function of radius at this 1.5 seconds. And you see that in the center, in the first 15 kilometers, the density is sort of 10 to the 14 grams per centimeter cubed. This is sort of 100 MeV to the fourth, I mean, including the 100 to the fourth. It's very, very high densities. And then as soon as you get to the edge of this proton-neutron star, the densities drop exponentially fast. And this is why sort of the Bram-Stralong process becomes inefficient that I was talking to Ruben. Because for the Bram-Stralong, it depends on the number density of neutrons times the number density of protons. So it's squared in that quantity, and that quantity is falling like a rock. So because most of our process actually frees out kind of to the right of this sharp cutoff, this is why we're mostly dominated by E plus E minus annihilation into dark matter. And this is just the temperature. And then you see it falls exponentially for a little bit, and then it plateaus and falls like a power law for a long time. So the rough behavior. And the temperature, it's actually slightly colder in the center, and it heats up near the edge. And this is just the fact that like the heat was first produced as a chemical potential for the neutrinos that then gets transferred to heat as they're trying to stream out. And so at the place where they find the least resistance, where they drop a lot of the energy. So that's why you find this feature that it's hotter at the edge. And it gets to sort of 30 to 50 MeV, depending on the profile you use. It falls very fast for a few kilometers after the edge, and then it flattens out and falls much more slowly once you're at the outside regions. And this is also not more or less easy to understand, is that once you're sort of at 1 or 2 MeV, it becomes harder to cool, because you typically cool by emitting neutrinos, and the neutrino production depends on the high power of temperature, so it's just much less efficient to cool down here, and so it sort of remains at this hottish temperatures for a long time.
And so the dark matter doesn't modify any of this, you expect?
So there are two different things that you can do when you're talking about supernovas. You can say, well, there are some things that we understand well enough about supernovas that we can't change. Then you can say, okay, I'm going to put bounds on dark matter parameters, asking that it doesn't do a bigger modification than sort of my misunderstanding allows. And this is what mostly goes under the name of cooling bounds. And I'm going to show you some photos, some plots, but like Ruben and Sam and I forget the name of your student.
Jacob.
Yeah, they did. They had a very nice paper recently where they're exploring that, including for modules like this. And we're focusing on couplings that are a little bit stronger, where you no longer get cooling bounds, so the modifications are small in the supernova evolution. But we're hoping that you could see a signal in that region, sort of.
But I could imagine it might change the temperature profile, for example.
Yeah, it could change, but I think the claim that it would be a small effect. I mean, if it changes it too much, yeah, there is some assumption that it's not changing things too significantly, I think I asked at some point some supernova person, like, oh, what would it take to put like some dark matter production inside a supernova code? And then they just laugh. I mean, they're not going to do it unless we give them a very good reason to do it. So. I mean, they're struggling to do their simulations with standard model, right? They can't really do a full simulation with not assuming some extra symmetry and putting all the processes. They can't do it because they don't have enough computer power to do it. So they're not going to do a BSM search unless it's incredibly motivated.
Putting in dark matter or something will help it maybe explode.
If it helps it explode, maybe it can do it a lot of times.
Because there's an extra transport of heat.
Yeah, but then you have to figure out how the dark matter. Yeah, you need to make the dark matter efficiently deposit the energy. If it doesn't, then it actually hurts because because it's taking energy out of the neutrinos. Yeah. So this is a good point that sort of Alex was telling Alex Friedland, that sort of you just had a new sink for energy, but it's not depositing the energy. It actually makes the core much. I mean, the bounce reviving the shock much worse because. The argument that people fight over is like some 20% efficiency in depositing energy. So if you have something that takes away an extra 20% of that energy, it goes in the wrong direction by as big of an effect as they're fighting about. So this is true. So now I've told you everything about how we're going to do our estimates and for a single supernova. And now I need to tell you what is our target. I mean, which kind of supernova are we searching for? There are, in principle, three candidates. One is we could be very lucky and have a single supernova event that has happened in the recent past for astrophysical purposes, but far past from our lifetime purposes. So not 1987A, but maybe something that happened 1,000 years ago or so, and it was relatively nearby, such that the signal is still getting to us right now. There is one candidate, but the uncertainties in the distance are so large that it makes it not that useful, so I'm not going to spend too much time talking about it, but I'll be happy to discuss it offline. What we're going to focus on is the diffuse signal from just integrating over past supernovas within our galaxy. So this will be the main, this is where I'm getting the results from. And we're assuming this rate, which seemed more or less agreed upon within the astrophysical community, which it is in the recent astrophysical past, so that means like hundreds of thousands of years, the rate of supernova in our galaxy is about 2 per century. And maybe it's 1 point something, maybe it's 3, but I mean, this just renormalized my signal by 1 or 3. There are larger uncertainties than this. Okay, and then there's also extragalactic supernova background, which is similar, but it's a little bit smaller. So that's why I'm focusing on this. In principle, you should add those two. But again, it's smaller than the uncertainties in the flux, so I don't care as much. And yeah, we've modeled it by there's some assumption about the distribution of the supernovas that sort of follows, I guess, the star formation rate within our galaxy. We use that, and then we use the fact that we know how many things are coming from a single supernova. And so you can compute, and roughly that gives you that the diffuse flux on Earth is this funny factor of about 0.04 of a single supernova that was at and then time at some characteristic distance from us that I don't know. I'm putting here some RSN, but it doesn't really matter. And then normalized to a kiloparsec. So the main message here is that a single supernova at a kiloparsec from which the signal was still getting to us now would give you a similar signal, would give you about a factor of 50 better than the diffuse. So sort of the distance range that you're really looking for did something interesting happen to us that was closer than a kiloparsec or not? And that's why this one candidate's sort of borderline interesting. If you look at the lower end of where it could be, it's about 0.5, but the higher end is almost 2. And so we decided it was too controversial to include it for now. And before I show you the results, let me just explain why we decided that the xenon detectors are the best. I don't think it's obvious. When we started this, because we had very much neutrinos in the back of our minds, like, come on, the biggest detector we have that has seen the neutrinos and is going to see a lot more neutrinos is Super K. The best candidate must be Super K. Well, the Super K threshold is very high. You need to deposit about 4 or 5 MeV of energy at Super K to see an event. You're with this kind of dark matter, even if it's coming with sort of tens of MeV, if it scatters off a nucleus, it's not going to give the nucleus tens of MeV of energy because the nucleus is too heavy. So maybe you can get it from an electron. The electron, now it's the opposite kinematics, right? The electron is too light. So you're trying to hit something very light with a very heavy guy. You can at most make the electron get transfer to the electron a momentum that's comparable to the electron mass times the velocity of the incoming dark matter. So even if I assume that the dark matter is relativistic, so I can make the electron or transfer sort of about an order of the mass of the electron, this is still much below 5 MeV. So there's just no way I can trigger on Super K. That's the issue. On top of that, you could try to go to detectors that are less, that have a lower threshold than Super K. For example, Borexino, which has seen solar neutrinos, so it can see much lower energies. But there, you just pay the price that the cross-section is somewhat small. I mean, typically, the cross-section has an extra, because it's a far-Feynman interaction, you end up getting an extra, it ends up being proportional by the mass of the electron. So usually, the cross-section is a bit too small, and you're swamped by backgrounds. That's what we found. On the other hand, if you go to nuclear targets, now the target is much heavier than the dark matter, so at least you're very efficient at transferring momentum, not necessarily energy, which means that basically the dark matter comes and just bounces off and transfers twice of its momentum to the target. So you can get 2 times the incoming dark matter momentum transferred to a nucleus. Also, because this is interacting almost as an ENM probe, it interacts with the whole charge of the nucleus, and we're transferring momenta that's much smaller than 100 MeV, so it's really getting the full coherence of the nucleus. And so the cross-section is enhanced by the charge of the nucleus squared. So you get sort of, you get one, a large momentum transfer, and you get this big enhancement in the cross-section. So this is why going for a very large nuclear detector is the best. I mean, we're flux limited, so as big as possible. That's why we're going for xenon. It's more maybe there's a better target. That's why I'm trying to explain what is the logic. I'd love to hear if you guys have a better idea. And currently at sort of xenon experiments, they're putting a threshold in their detector that's about 5 keV, so you need to transfer about 5 keV. And and you know what is the recoil energy if you transfer twice the dark matter momenta. This is the recoil energy, and that tells you that the dark matter must have come with at least 17 MeV of momenta. And this is in a sense why we become more inefficient as we go to lower masses of the dark matter, just because typically lower dark matter masses, dark matter that's lighter, decouples further out, typically in our, just because of how the cross sections work, and it's coming from a region with smaller temperature, and then it usually pay a huge exponential price to reach the 17 MeV. So this is why you'll see in our plots that typically our possibility of detection becomes much, much worse at lower masses. And again, just as a side comment, you can also put cooling bounds. I put a curve that's very much just a rough approximation of where the cooling bounds are. We're going to do a slightly better job in the final version, but also you should look at Ruva and Sam's work, recent work, to see other plots in this. And so here's the result. So this is what you should expect to see in different experiments. Making some assumptions. So here we require that you get about order 4 or 5 events within the exposure, and we assume that they're going to keep the threshold at 5 keV, and we also assume that the luminosity, I mean, we've used a very specific time for computing everything, right? It was 1-point-something seconds after the bounce. We have to assume what is the time evolution of the luminosity. We assume that it's the same as the neutrinos, which is roughly the luminosity is falling as 1 over time. So with that, we get that sort of LZ should be able to explore already a reasonable range of parameters. And you see that sort of eventually cooling. I mean, we would see even more events here, but those points are already excluded by cooling. And Darwin, which is this ultimate experiment that's going to touch the neutrino floor, is going to explore an even wider range of parameters. If the experiments lower their threshold, and we assume that backgrounds are not going to become an issue, which that they're going to lower the threshold is almost certain. I mean, LZ saying that they could easily reach 3 or 2.5 keV energy recoil thresholds. That's their, that's their current understanding of what they can do. Then there needs to be some assessment if, with that lowering, how much background are we going to see? But if we don't see that much background, then even xenon 1-ton, if it lowers its threshold, should already be able to probe some of the parameter space, and you get a much larger byte of parameter space if you do this. One thing that maybe, it's somewhat clear already from this picture, but maybe it's worth emphasizing, is that these types of processes, because of this trapping, have the very weird property that the number of events that you expect to see on Earth decreases as you increase the coupling, right? So in a sense, if the flux was constant, increasing the coupling is good because you just increase the chance that your detector sees a signal. But the flux decreases much faster as a function of coupling, just because this trapping is very efficient. And so you can see that sort of here we're usually assuming four events. As you go down, the number of events increases very fast. And so hopefully maybe in the future, by trying to use the difference in the shape, you could even distinguish dark matter that was being produced inside supernovas from something that is gravitationally bound to our galaxy, because the shape of the nuclear recoil should be relatively different. This is important because, well, if any of these experiments see a signal, they would definitely declare that they've detected 10 GeV dark matter and not what we're talking about here. So we would need to be able to disentangle the two signals. So this brings me to my conclusions. I hope I've convinced you that sort of it's an interesting idea to search for astrophysically produced dark matter. It has it allows you to use detectors that were designed for much heavier dark matter. Use those detectors to probe for much lighter species. there's some parameter space that might even be probed by xenon 1-ton if they are able to lower their thresholds without getting too much background. We try to be as conservative as possible in most of our estimates for the fluxes. So maybe once we actually run the simulations with Dan, we might find that we were being too conservative, and maybe that will allow us to extend to larger ranges of parameters. So stay tuned. We also need to explore more profiles. I mean, we currently imagine that profiles make a change in the flux by order of 2 or 3. That's why we're requiring sort of detecting 5, 6 events, because if we made some mistake by order 2, we would still get enough events. But we still need to examine this. And maybe we just took an unlucky profile. I'm not holding my breath. I think it's all about the same. And more importantly, I mean, once we have everything under control, we hope that we can extend this to many, many other models. I mean, we're exploring this very simple model, but in principle, almost anything that's sort of between mass 10 MeV and hundreds of MeV that couples to the standard model could be probed by this type of thing. It's just that the physics inside the supernova can become too complicated, and so we need to first understand the simple case first in order to add complications as we go. Thank you.
So if you lower the threshold, how much more do you gain? So it depends
a lot on the mass. So you gain a lot on the lower masses. In the heavier masses, you don't gain by that much. So maybe it's... So see, like, the heavier masses move very little. Oh, no, the wrong direction. But you see, I get this huge gain here. I mean, you're already, like, in a... falling exponential, so you could gain significantly. The problem is that, I mean, you definitely cannot go below 1 kV, because then you're really swamped by backgrounds. I mean, here we're assuming that maybe at 2.5 kV, you're still not background dominated at those experiments. But it's...
Sorry, why are you swamped by backgrounds?
Oh, because you start seeing a lot of the beryllium 8 neutrinos from the sun.
Oh, sorry, because you do my LZ
diagram. Yeah.
I think I've been asking about this at the APS conference, so I can't remember. But so in terms of like the dark matter interpretation of this, so below the Rayleigh density, think of it as dark matter doesn't really make sense, because now the coupling still light you would have overclosed.
Yeah, but I mean, that's partly, but being most of this region here, you have sort of enough time to fix the cosmology. I mean, if you try to do some, you need to do some extra module building. So the stupidest thing I could do is I could have this and a small entropy dump to dilute it by order 1.
But I guess what I was going to say is, because everything you talk about doesn't depend at all on the cosmological dark matter density, that maybe a better role for the model is like, this is like some particle that's just part of a dark sector, but it also like helps fix some other problem that would have given you the Rayleigh density. You know, like it.
Yeah, no, yeah.
Like in the context of a model like that, this I think would be great.
Yeah, no, it's true. Yeah. As long as it's stable on sort of astrophysical timescales, it doesn't need to be stable even on cosmological timescales. Nothing changes, right? I mean, we just need it.
Yeah.
But the problem is that whenever you assume that there's something lighter than this, you need to also include the dynamics of that lighter thing inside the supernova. That's why we haven't put the dark photon. Because then you need to figure out when does the dark photon decouple from the standard model, and the dark photon decouple from the dark matter. So you just have too many processes. So I think then doing the analytical estimate is hopeless. Once we're doing the simulation, I don't think it will be as big of a difference, because then you just need to put in the cross section as a function of energy at each radius and simulate it. So that's the hope, that once we have the dense code, we can start doing more complicated things. Currently, like in once I have to track multiple species, it's too complicated. That's why we're not doing the lighter dark photon yet. And also, for example, I mean, in this parameter space, if nothing changes too much, this is where like some of the SIMPs or elder parameters would be here. But there's extra dynamics that we would need to put in. I mean, we need to figure out how to do this 2 to 3 type processes and things like that. So.
Oh, you mean like the Rayleigh density curve, like those
goes
shift
down.
Down.
Yeah.
Inside the region.
Yeah. So there are. Oh yes.
So you mentioned that the threshold in xenon 10 and xenon 1-ton is 15 kV.
No, I was thinking about xenon 1-ton already, because those smaller ones, they're not sensitive to such small flux. So at xenon 1-ton, it's 5 kV.
And the previous detectors?
Sorry?
And the previous detectors?
The previous, I don't remember, because we didn't look since we realized that the sensitivity was not, even if the threshold was 5 kV, they were too small to detect such a small flux.
Because it's
what are KV?
The Dama Libra had a threshold of 2 kV or smaller. So is this indeed a big gap between the threshold and the distance?
Yeah, I mean, it depends a lot on what is the nucleus that you're looking at, to what, where you put, what, where is the threshold, right? So xenon is, I never looked at Dhamma super carefully, so I don't remember, but I just know that the xenon, they're typically order 5, and then so some spread around that, but that's the
two. Maybe order 1 or 2.
But I think their efficiencies go down a lot, right? Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I don't know.
Have you looked at micro experiment? That thing was pretty huge, right?
Oh no, I haven't looked. No.
So, yeah, I think they have. You said like it's about an MeV energy deposition or so. So they should.
No, MeV. No, few MeV momentum deposition.
Ah, momentum.
Yeah, energy depends.
It's relativistic, so.
Semi-relativistic, so.
In the multi-KV.
Yeah, it's probably in the multi-KV. Yeah,
so that was a scintillator. So.
Yeah. So. Yeah, if you're coming with if it's interacting, for example, with electrons, then you can get it to deposit sort of orders of hundreds of kV in the electrons. What I found so far is that any electron experiment that is, because this, you're only depositing these hundreds of kV, the pp neutrinos from the sun are a huge background, and their flux is just enormous. I mean, it's usually orders of magnitude above this. So even though the coupling of this thing is bigger than the neutrinos, it's not bigger by orders of magnitude to compensate for the flux. I mean, the flux of pp neutrinos is just absurd in the units of these types of rare events.
So what is the flux roughly?
Oh, yeah, it depends a lot on the coupling. I don't remember. I don't think I have a plot. No, I don't have a plot. Yeah, I can try to find it. I have some old plot in my computer somewhere that we had. I mean, it's a sort of exponential dependence on y, so it depends a lot on where you are.
So if you were to scatter the electrons, for example, in dominant by LC, there you just say you're dominated by pp neutrino.
Yeah, you're just dominated by pp neutrino.
Typical energy is hundreds of kV.
Hundreds of kV, yeah, so. Yeah.
How realistic is Darwin and nothing about that? Is that, should I view that as something that's very futuristic? Or?
I mean, LZ is being built, in my understanding. I don't know. In the conference, they said that we are going to get to the floor within 15, 20 years. I don't know how to take that at face value. But
wait, Darwin is just a scaled up version of
it. It's just a scale, yeah. So I mean, it all depends on none of the new experiments finding a bottleneck, right? Yeah, I mean, it could be that you build LZ and discover, oh man, there's this extra background that we didn't think was going to creep in. And so there is, bearing that, I think they have the plan to continue going. Like either with Darwin, there's also, I think, Panda 40X or some equivalent version of this in China that's going to get to the hundreds of ton year exposure. So I think there's interest in the community to build them. Of course, I don't know. I mean, I'm even worried because Xenon Wonton said that they're going to announce the results 1 month ago and they haven't. So maybe they've already found a bottleneck. I don't know. I'm assuming.
It's a liquid argon. Big ones, 50 tons.
Do you know where the minimum coupling is for just maintaining kinetic equilibrium? Like I could essentially just draw, like let's forget where I get the right relic abundance from Fritz out, but just demand that I'm at some point equilibrating with the standard model bath, so that I could put like a lower bound on my coupling cosmologically somehow.
Well, I mean, the thing is that, I mean, it's very model dependent, right? Because, I mean, this thing has a small coupling only because you are in this regime where you've integrated out the dark photon. And so as you go to lower energies, your coupling is becoming smaller and smaller. But as soon as they restore the dark photon, typically the cross-section becomes large. I mean, depending on epsilon, but I mean, you know, epsilon can be pretty small and you still maintain kinetic equilibrium. So it's too model dependent to say.
Like the elder line, right?
Yeah, I think the elder line is sort of. If I remember correctly, in this plot is somewhere like. I have the elder line somewhere here, right? In the. Yeah, so I guess it's down here. Also, in the so it's not mine. It's Dan's. But the idea is that, I mean, because we're treating the centered model part of the supernova as a fixed background, because we're assuming that the time evolution of that is much slower than what we're interested in, so we can compute what is the rate at which you're producing dark matter, and then as a function of radius, you can also you know what is the mean free path of dark matter to do any of the other interactions. So you sort of, it's a Monte Carlo thing. You produce a bunch of things based on based on this rate, and then you evolve some of them to see how many of them survive and how many of them migrate to different place, and then you try to update what is the dark. So you start with a guess for the dark matter distribution, and you do that, and then you try to update that until you reach a steady state. That's roughly what the code is doing. How it's exactly doing it, I don't know. I mean, this is it's Dan's expertise. I mean, he's someone that does transport in kind of supernova and things like this. I'm hoping that I will not have to actually contribute to this code. We'll see. I mean, I'm contributing with all the computing, all of the things that they had to input, but I don't actually have to go in and do some of the coding myself. Yeah.
Which one is this single supernova that you think might or might not be?
Oh, is this thing called Vela Junior? So we see the remnant, and it's pretty close. Well, at some point people said that it was even 700 light years from us, which is really, really close. But apparently, like, more recent observations say that there is a lower bound at 0.5 kiloparsec and an upper bound at 1.5, and they can't quite figure out. We also don't know exactly when it went off, but there's some indication it was probably about 1,000 years ago. I mean, the light reached us, not that it went off.
Not in the historical record.
It's not in the historical record, but people have some arguments for why we wouldn't have seen it. I think it was mostly visible in the southern hemisphere, which people didn't keep track of the observations, or maybe they did and we just killed everyone that knew how to read it.
How big of a time window do you need to be able to see something?
So you need that the explosion has happened about an order. I mean, if you translate the distance in light years, you need that the explosion happened within a factor of a few of the distance. Because this thing is going to take sort of about a factor of a few longer than the light to reach us. Let's see.
I just mean you're not limited by like a 10-second window, obviously.
No.
But it's
distance dependent how much of the window it is. So it's proportional to the distance by a factor of a few. If it was a single guy, also it's interesting because the flux we would be seeing is totally monochromatic. So that one would have a very interesting feature in terms of how you would detect it, right? Because you would select a very specific momentum shell to reach us now. If somehow we discover that this Vela Junior is very close, then it would be pretty awesome. And the bounds are stronger, and also it has more interesting features. But currently, it's much more uncertain than the diffuse one that we're plotting.
Okay, great. Nothing else? Then let's start again.